Geekscape.com.
Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and today's narration will be the sixth one from Front Camphor by Et Volsink. During the years he spent with the Brandenburg ZBV 800, Et encountered many strange characters and individuals, but perhaps the strangest was Bert, who was a Jesuit monk. Within the Roman Catholic Church, there are several monastic orders, both male and female, living under a variety of rules and observances, but each dedicated to the Pope and the service of his church. There are many factions spread across the whole of the Roman Catholic world, some living in cloisters under rigorous and often unbearable discipline. In these closed orders, an abbot or prioress is the absolute ruler, holding the lives of their subordinates in total control. Some orders are so strict that nobody is allowed to speak except in prayer or singing hymns. Others are based in more open communities or range widely in the mainstream society. The names of these orders are often well known: the Franciscans, the Dominicans, the Knights of St. George and St. John. These men and women spend their lives in absolute service of their God and Pope, often working among the poor and incurably diseased of Africa or South America. The expansion and propagation of the Church of Rome dominates their every thought and deed. Among all the various orders of the Roman Catholic Church, the Congregation of the Jesuits is the most militant, founded some centuries ago by a former soldier, Ignatius Loyola. The Jesuits were the spearhead of Roman Catholicism, sworn to protect their church and pope against any danger. The church grew to become a world power, with influence over kings and emperors. Its tentacles spread across the globe in both politics and public life. Among the world's largest religions, Islam, Buddhism, and Brahmanism, the Church of Rome was the fourth greatest, with the Pope as sole representative of Christ on earth. The Pope was the most powerful priest in the world, and the Jesuits in turn were powerful as a force within that church and rapidly became known as its defenders. The Jesuit order became notorious for its role in the Inquisition, the war against the Protestants, the Counter-Reformation, the persecution of witches across Europe. The Jesuits became the Pope's strong hand. Their highest rank was general, with power over life and death. The monks and priests had ranks like soldiers, and often led armies of the faithful. The Jesuit motto was not so much, "Love your fellow man," in the Christian tradition, but more often, "The end justifies our means." The Jesuits had so much in common with the National Socialist movement in their structure and their discipline. The determination to serve the church, to be prepared to kill and sacrifice all for their God, was comparable to the National Socialist fight to preserve the race and culture at all costs. The Jesuits were interested in power and would commit treason and atrocities, acting as a kind of mafia within the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, it was said by some that Reichsfuhrer Himmler had based the internal structure of the SS on the Jesuit model. However, Et was to learn more about the Jesuits by personal experience when he became an unwilling and unknown collaborator of the Jesuit order. And this happened in early 1942, shortly after Et had joined the permanent Kampfergruppe. He had completed his exhaustive training with the Special Command of the ZBV 800. He had already completed several missions behind the existing front lines, and at that time held the rank of corporal. On this occasion, his group were suddenly recalled to their depot, and at a very short notice were parachute dropped onto the Mediterranean coast near Monaco. The situation in this theatre of the war was complicated. When France capitulated to Germany, In May 1940, the Wehrmacht, leaving the southern provinces to French control by the Vichy government of Marshal Pétain. The Vichy government was pro-Axis, but did not have an army, relying instead on a federal armed police force for internal security. It was always understood that where Vichy could not protect itself, German military assistance would be provided. This situation was not helped by the presence of Germany's Italian ally along the French border, because the Italians were obliged to secure their side of the border with much better military forces than the Vichy police could hope to maintain. Ett himself had a very low opinion of these Italian forces. He considered that the Brandenburg ZBV 800 was regularly being thrown into situations where an Italian unit had made a costly mistake. The Italian military operations in the Balkans were a poor performance, and frequently German divisions had to be sent to clear up the Italians' mess when those forces were needed elsewhere. There were some exceptions, as Ett was to learn after the war from other Waffen-SS comrades. Some of the elite Italian Alpine units and paratroop formations fought well and with courage. The Italian divisions on the Eastern Front were brave and fought hard defensive battles. On this occasion, the Brandenburg Kampfgruppe had been sent in to solve a problem on the French-Italian border. For some reason, a poorly equipped French police unit was fighting against a superior Italian contingent who, for whatever purpose, were attempting to penetrate into Vichy territory. Unfortunately for the Italians, the weakly equipped French had struck hard and driven them back along narrow mountain roads deep into Italian territory. The Brandenburgers were dropped by parachute into the mountains, close to the area where the fighting was taking place. The situation was extremely confused, both from a military position and a political position. As an NCO of minor rank, Ett had no idea what his commander's strategy was to be in this operation, but the orders were simply that they had to intervene to stop the fighting, then restore the frontiers to their original status, and to avoid further bloodshed, if at all possible. As there was no radio contact between the Brandenburgers and the two opposing factions, the Kampfgruppe had been provided with two megaphones. When they regrouped after the drop, Ett was given a megaphone to use, as he was classed as a French-speaking specialist. The other megaphone was handed to another Dutch Brandenburger, who was an Italian speaker. Ett was later to learn from his comrade that he could speak and write in more than 20 languages fluently, a real genius indeed. The Kampfgruppe split up, and Ett set out with a group of 25 others under the command of a very young lieutenant to descend the slopes down towards the French positions. He was able to make contact with the French force through the megaphone and succeeded in halting the French advance. It was quickly made clear to the French that the requested German relief forces were now in the area and all French deployments were brought to a standstill. The other Brandenburg detachment repeated the exercise with the Italians, but met with some resistance and were forced to take direct action. The Brandenburgers engaged the forward Italian elements, destroying an armoured car with hand grenades and shooting several Italians who refused to comply with German instructions. After the brief display of German firepower, the Italians were more willing to listen, and the German commander invited representatives of both sides to discuss the situation under German supervision. The talks were held directly through the mediation of the German commander, with Ett acting as interpreter for the French and his fellow Dutch Brandenburger as interpreter for the Italians. Within a short time, the two sides were convinced to break hostilities and return to their original positions. After the Brandenburgers had supervised the withdrawal of the two opposing factions, the Kampfgruppe was transported by Italian vehicles to a nearby Italian military airfield. During the journey to the airfield, Ett had ample time to get to know his Dutch comrade and to find out more about his gifted compatriot. The other Dutchman was called Bert, but in contrast to Ett, gave no details about family, home, or any aspects of his pre-war life. However, because of his considerable skills in foreign languages, Bert was often assigned to different Brandenburg Kampfergruppen and had travelled around the various subunits of the ZBV 800. Through the conversation, Ett was able to discover that not only was Bert an extreme anti-communist, but also a confirmed Christian. This latter point was not unknown in the Brandenburg, which was a regular Wehrmacht formation, but would have been unusual in the Waffen-SS. Once at the airfield, the Kampfergruppe boarded transport aircraft and were flown back to their operations base. It did not see Bert again for some considerable time, as Bert was immediately assigned to other units. Some months later, when Ett had been promoted to officer rank, he again met Bert, only to discover that Bert had received promotion too, but only to Hauptfeldwebel, a senior non-commissioned officer. Although Hauptfeldwebel was the highest NCO grade, it usually excluded a further promotion. Ett asked Bert about this unusual situation, only to be told that it was down to Bert's own wishes, as he did not feel capable of acting as an officer. During future actions, Bert served under Ett's command many times and showed himself to be an expert killer who knew and used all the tricks of commando warfare. Ett and Bert served together on numerous operations in the East, especially where written agreements had to be made in Russian, Slavic, or South European languages. Bert was also quite a ladies' man, and made a reputation for himself when the Kampfergruppen were on rest and refit in the rear echelons. Bert was quite a force with the female army auxiliaries. After the war, when Ett had returned to civilian life, he asked among his fellow veterans about Bert, but nobody had seen him after the capitulation. Then, one night while Ett was training in hotel management at the Beethoven Hotel in Amsterdam, he received a call from the Chevalier d'Or, a select nightclub in the same street. A familiar voice told Ett that he was the manager of the club, and that his stock of Genever, Dutch gin, still scarce and rationed at this time, was out of stock. Could Ett possibly lend him 6 bottles until the next day? Ett agreed, and his caller told him that he would call around to collect them personally, and added that Ett knew him very well. After 5 minutes, the caller arrived at Ett's bar. It was Bert, no longer in uniform, but wearing a regular hotel dinner jacket. The two men embraced like lost brothers, but Bert cut short Ett's rapid burst of questions, saying that he was in a hurry, and would explain everything the next morning when he returned to the gin. It was the next day when Ett learned a great deal about his old comrade Bert. Bert was, in fact, a Jesuit monk who was loaned to the Brandenburg to fight against Bolshevism and represent the church's special interests. He later showed Ett his monastery on the Hopmakard, and for a time he and Ett were in regular contact. Then Bert was once again moved on, and Ett only saw him once again, this time some years later still. Ett was working for NATO and needed the help of Bert and his congregation in a rather dubious operation. It was difficult for Ett to make contact with Bert, and on this occasion, as Bert was now a professor of theology and had a tight and respectable circle around him, Ett eventually made the breakthrough, using his old wartime name to gain access to his former comrade, but Bert was quite willing to help, just like the old days of wartime, which he had never forgotten. The last time Ett heard of Bert was when he saw a photograph in a large article in the daily newspaper. Bert was now operating at very high office within his congregation and was living somewhere in Italy. The former Brandenburg special fighter was now serving as a strong arm of the Holy Roman Church, in command of the mysterious global operations of the Jesuit order. For all this, Ett maintained that Bert was, and still is, a National Socialist at heart. In his many and varied wartime experiences, Ed Welsink encountered treason on a number of occasions and in different forms. As recounted in a previous chapter, he encountered treason among the enemy and treason within the ranks of the Wehrmacht itself. But the one place he did not expect to encounter treasonous behaviour was within his own family. Although the circumstances were very minor and of little real harm to the Reich war effort, the situation left Ed with a feeling of panic and anger. However, despite his desire to urgently do something about the situation, because the episode revolved around his own mother, he did nothing. In the Brandenburg Division, as in any Wehrmacht formation, the soldiers went home on leave when circumstances allowed. Ed was no exception, and until such time as he became leader of a Kampfgruppe in the ZBV 800, he took leave like any other. Later in the war, he could only get leave on rare occasions, and as a Kampfgruppe officer, was expected to break off leave and return to the unit if there was a crisis. Ed had so many friends and relatives living in Germany that he normally spent his leave in the Reich, rather than at his parents' home in the Netherlands. Moreover, as Ed progressed in his chosen military profession, and the promotions began to follow, he frequently skipped his entitlement to leave because, as he put it, there was a war to win and a career to make. After each succession of special actions, there was usually a period of rest and refit, which was generally spent in one of the Erholungsheime, the military rest centres. Such contact as Ed had with home was limited to correspondence via his field post office. As an elite unit, the Brandenburg field post numbers received preferential treatment in delivery. However, Ed complained that correspondence between himself, his parents, his relatives, and his girlfriend back in Holland was quite one-sided. Whereas they could all write to him about any subject, he could not write to them about anything, not his actions at the front, nor his whereabouts, nothing about his unit, and nothing about his connections with the RSHA. On top of that, Ed had little time to write, and his interest in correspondence generally declined, becoming a duty rather than a pleasure. Later, as a Kampfgruppe officer, it was sometimes possible for Ed to telephone his parents from Berlin, although generally this was strictly forbidden. On one such occasion, he learned that his mother had to go into hospital to undergo a serious gynecological operation, so Ed applied for and received a long leave of absence. Using his good contacts at the RSHA, he obtained a seat on an aircraft flying to Amsterdam Schiphol, which speeded up his travel time and avoided a tedious train journey. In Amsterdam, his father had permanent use of two adjoining rooms at the Krasnopolsky Hotel. Ed made straight for the hotel and checked in at the reception desk, only to discover that his father was not there. He knew that his father was probably out of town on business, so he decided to wait. Shortly after, there was a telephone call to the hotel, from his father, informing him that his father was about to catch a train to Amsterdam, and asked Ed to take the smaller of the two rooms at the hotel, and he would meet him later. Herr Welsink, several foreign, including before the war. In addition to this, he was also the sales director of his own factory in the south of Holland, and frequently had to travel away from home. Ed settled into the Krasnopolsky Hotel and unpacked what little luggage he had brought with him. After showering and shaving, he hesitated as to which uniform he should wear. Ed had travelled in his normal Brandenburg combat uniform, which he regarded as a second skin. However, as military regulations demanded, he had also brought along the regulation officer's walking about uniform, with shiny boots and peaked cap. This stiff and formal attire felt unfamiliar and almost alien to Ed, who had only ever used the dress uniform on three or four special occasions. He decided against it, intending to have some fun in the officers' club next door to the hotel, so Ed dressed in his camouflage outfit. When he entered the officers' club, there was a distinct silence among the dandy junior officers in their smartly tailored uniforms. Ed realized that his rank showed clearly, and his combat decorations were impressive. Otherwise, they would have thrown him out of their prestigious company. The one-legged NCO on duty in the club's hallway asked Ed to wait for the club's supervisor before ordering a drink. The officers' club supervisor turned out to be an elderly major. He reported to the major in the formal military fashion and noted the friendly response when he said the word Brandenburg. Ed presented his leave papers and sold book for inspection and was immediately granted the hospitality of the club. The major accompanied him to the bar and offered him a welcoming drink. Word quickly spread around the club about the new arrival, and Ed found himself joined by several staff officers from a variety of units, eager to buy him drinks and question him about his experiences. Ed was not a heavy drinker, and only ever drank beer. In no time at all he had consumed 3 beers, his limit, and was desperate to stay sober. At this point, he bought a round of drinks for his bar companions and was preparing to leave when into the club walked his father. The older Herr Volsink was not a man to be stopped by military regulations, and he strode straight to the bar to greet his son. Ed accompanied his father back to the hotel, where he learned more about his mother's medical problems. The situation was not as serious as had first been thought, and she was now waiting for a call from the local hospital to undergo minor surgery. Ed's father switched his attention to his son, noting proudly Ed's combat decorations and the rank insignia of First Lieutenant, Oberlieutenant, but asked quizzically if Ed possessed a normal uniform rather than the camouflage suit. Ed replied that he did indeed possess, asked to wear it to visit home the next day. Ed's mother valued decorum and social graces, so reluctantly he agreed to dress up for her. Although he did not know it at the time, his appearance in regular Wehrmacht uniform on this occasion would save his life after the capitulation. At his post-war trial, the prosecution failed to prove that Ed was an officer in the notorious Brandenburg, and not the simple SS Sturmmann in whose uniform he had surrendered. This was because an invalid Wehrmacht officer serving with the local occupation forces was billeted with Ed's parents as a lodger. The presence of Ed in his dress uniform at their home was put down to mistaken identity, the court being unable to prove that the lodger and Ed were two separate officers in the same house. If Ed had been identified as a Brandenburg officer, the Dutch court would have imposed an immediate death sentence. That night, Ed's father took him out to one of the smartest restaurants in Amsterdam, where he was treated as a regular customer of their black market cuisine. Ed enjoyed the food, drink, and atmosphere after months at the front, but felt bitter at the sight of war profiteers spending vast amounts of money on fine wines and foods. The bitterness grew as he later went to a nightclub where the same wealth was lavishly squandered on entertainment, while Ed knew that at the front, thousands of soldiers were living and dying every day in appalling conditions. He could not blame his father for what he saw or for his lack of sacrifice. His father could not serve as a soldier because of tuberculosis and typhoid in childhood. Plus, Herr Volsink Sr. had a vital post in war production. The next day, Ed put on his fancy uniform and went home to please his mother. It had been over 1.5 years since she had last seen him, and she embraced him in floods of tears. Ed spent the day in the family atmosphere of the returned son, and all was well until the evening. The house his parents owned was quite large, with a big living room, which could be divided by sliding doors, which left the two halves quite soundproof. The Volsinks had a large family radio set in the street-side part of the divided living room. The radio was unusual because the German occupation authorities had confiscated all radio sets in public hands, except those belonging to pro-German families. This was because the London-based Radio Orange sent daily propaganda broadcasts to the Netherlands to undermine the authorities and to create discontent among the Dutch population. In addition, the broadcasts were also used to send coded messages to the terrorists of the Dutch underground, at this time not very significant, and to help stranded Allied aircrews escape back to England. That evening, Ed's father received a visit from various important Dutch National Socialists and German officers. They sat to discuss business in the back room. Ed was introduced to the mayor, to the German Ortskommandant, the SD leader of the local police, and some NSB officials. He was greeted and saluted respectfully by those who had seen him go off to war as a very young private soldier, now returned as a much decorated officer. The gathered officers got down to the business of the evening, discussing the daily measures needed to keep the essential war industries running, the issues of public order and security, and so on. After a short period of time and a few drinks, Ed became bored with the minutiae of home front administration. He rose to his feet and excused himself, leaving to enter the front room, where his mother was entertaining some of her female friends. To Ed's surprise, he found that the sliding doors were firmly locked. Puzzled by this, he walked around through the hall and entered the room through the other door. The group of about five women looked up at the intruder in fearful astonishment. A German officer had suddenly appeared in their midst. Ed's mother called out reassuringly, "It's my son, it's Ed." Then it was his turn to be surprised, as he realized at what the women were doing. They were all grouped around listening to the radio set. The astonishment for Ed was the voice on the radio. It was the detested voice of Queen Wilhelmina, broadcasting from London, and using the foulest of language to describe the pro-German Dutch. Her broadcasts frequently used language and descriptions that even the Soviet radio propagandists avoided. Ed left the room immediately, in a state of bewilderment, not knowing what to do. If he had discovered such a situation in hostile territory, he would have let his weapons do the talking. But here, among his own family, in his father's house, he was at a loss. His parents had educated him politically and brought him up to be a loyal National Socialist, yet here in their house his mother was allowing her friends to listen to enemy broadcasts. Bringing himself under control, he quietly returned to the back room. Seeing his father in deep discussion with some prominent officials, he decided against embarrassing him in this company. Ed was sure that his father knew what was happening just a few meters away through the doors. Added to the bitterness he felt at the war profiteers in the nightclub the night before, Ed was struggling to control his temper. Only the Ortskommandant noticed Ed standing there. Looking up, he asked Ed if there was something he could do to help him while he was on leave. The officer was an older man, a captain in the Luftwaffe, who obviously sensed that something was troubling Ed. Perhaps he too had sons or even grandsons fighting at the front. Ed asked if there was a Wehrmachtsheim, a pub or hostel for soldiers on leave in the town, as he would like to see if any old friends were in town on leave. The officer replied that there was such a place, but it was not exactly of Ed's high standards. If he wished, his driver would drop him there. Ed agreed and went out of the house with the officer to his car. The old motor car, with its equally old Luftwaffe driver, was put at Ed's disposal, taking him out through the dark and empty streets of his hometown. It was long after curfew time, and there was little military traffic in the town at night. The car stopped outside a pub, which Ed had never visited before, and the manager came out to greet him. He was an old acquaintance of Ed's family, a half-Dutch, half-German fellow, a former handyman who even before the war had never hidden his pro-German feelings. He was, however, surprised to see an officer interested in visiting his rather shabby premises, then after a few seconds he recognised Ed. The publican boomed out his greetings. "Heil Hitler! Ed, this is an exceptional day. Kuss is here, Pieter Vluten, and many more too. I'm getting the impression that the war is over, with so many here on leave." Ed was among comrades again, mostly soldiers of the various Waffen-SS formations, with a few sailors of the Kriegsmarine mixed in. They sat talking and drinking beer, telling their own war stories, and remembering their days as members of the Jugdsturm. Cautiously, Ed raised the question of the radio listening, and was surprised to hear that it was not uncommon. Even in loyal National Socialist families, it appeared to be a regular activity to listen to Radio Orange. One of his comrades suggested that it was good for their mentality to hear the voice of their detested and absent queen. Her foul tongue was surely the best means of convincing the Dutch that they were well rid of their royals and moved closer to the Führer. Ed remembered the faces around the radio, at his parents' house, and had his doubts, but refrained from mentioning the incident. Ed drank well into the night with his comrades until closing time, when half drunk he was taken home by the old friend Charlie the pub manager. Ed rang the doorbell and was let in by Fien, the maidservant, saying nothing as he silently went to his room. The next morning, Ed argued furiously with his father. His father saw nothing wrong in his wife's behaviour, and when asked about her friends, he dismissed that as being a mere trifle about which he was too busy to be concerned. Ed shouted angrily that it was not trifles to allow treason in the house. He became so angry in the shouting match with his father that he grabbed the older man by the lapels of his jacket. It was then that Ed saw the small silver badge on his father's lapel, the death's head badge of a senior member of the Allgemeine SS. Ed became even more angry. He knew nothing of his father's position or membership in the SS, and in these circumstances was furious. How could he wear that badge and allow such treasonous behaviour in his own home? He could openly wear the SS badge because of people like his son. Ed left the house in a rage and went straight to the Ortskommandante. He was admitted at once and shown into the office of the elderly captain. As he was on official grounds, he began his report in the formal military manner, but the officer interrupted him and asked in a fatherly way what he could do for Ed. Ed decided against causing trouble for his family, so he produced his leave papers and told the old officer that he wanted to return to his unit in Berlin-Brandenburg because he could not stand the atmosphere in his hometown a moment longer, and he asked him to... The old officer stood looking at Ed in deep thought, but did not ask for further explanations. Then, after a few moments, he said that he could of course issue fresh marching orders for an earlier day of return, officially ending the term of leave. Ed asked him to arrange for an official emergency recall from the Brandenburg, but this, the old man said, was beyond his powers and authority. Instead, he offered to phone Ed's mother at home and ask her to pass on the bad news to her son immediately. The ruse was acceptable and would avoid a family crisis before his mother's operation. Duty before all was the magic expression in their world and would provide the necessary cover story for Ed's departure. The captain did not waste any time. The marching orders were prepared straight away, signed and stamped while Ed waited in his office. He also made the necessary telephone call while Ed listened. He could tell from the conversation that his mother was making a lot of protests, but was told that there was nothing the Ortskommandante could do. He had to return to his unit. Your son simply has to obey, like any other German soldier. There were lots of tears at home, but within a few hours, Ett was on a train beginning the long journey back to Berlin. He had not solved the problem of this personal treason within his family, and did not see his parents again until long after the capitulation, and in the most miserable of circumstances. It is without doubt one of the strangest aspects of politics in the war years of the Third Reich that a group of high-ranking German officers, together with politicized civilian collaborators, plotted to overthrow Adolf Hitler and his National Socialist government. The reality of the situation was that the Führer enjoyed unprecedented support among the German people, and that those plotting against his regime were a motley collection of diverse interests. The opposition to Hitler within Germany were a series of special interest groups, traditional Junkers, Prussian aristocrats longing for the feudal past, embittered social democrats and communists ousted from public life by the National Socialist Revolution, fringe religious fanatics opposed to militarism and the war in general, ambitious politicians who were attracted to the NSDAP only as a means to personal advancement and sought to subvert the system for their own ends. The mid-war period of 1943 onwards saw these disruptive elements operating as a loose coalition against the Reich, and in tandem with political émigrés outside Germany and the Soviet and Allied espionage networks. The subversive political elements within Germany were monitored by both the regular police services and the political police services of the Gestapo and SD. As an officer of the Allgemeine SS, intentionally placed in the Brandenburg ZBV 800 by the RSHA, Ed Volsink was well situated to be involved in the behind-the-scenes manoeuvres to counter this threat to the Reich. Although the anti-Hitler groups were small in number, they were at the same time dangerous because certain highly placed staff officers could manipulate large-scale army units into their service without the rank-and-file soldiers being aware of how they were being used. During the 3 years he served in the Brandenburg, Ed Volsink had relatively few periods away from the Brandenburg ZBV 800 or its supporting installations. On the few occasions he had leave, he could be contacted quickly through his field mail number, which carried a special urgency code. The ZBV 800 could use the field mail system to recall essential personnel from leave, from hospital, or convalescence in an Erholungsheim. Ed had been seriously wounded in Russia, and after hospital treatment was considered not yet fit to return to frontline duties. Therefore, the Brandenburg headquarters, in consultation with the section staff, assigned Ed to supervise guard units in the rear echelon lines in southern Russia. The temporary command would last until Ed was fit to return to the Kampfgruppen. He was to take over from an old major who was being transferred back to Germany to serve in the anti-aircraft command. He took over the former commander's quarters, which he found adequate and very cosy, but not in keeping with his personal ideas of what an officer's lodgings should be like. Ed was keen to return to the Brandenburg, where he felt his career was better served, to gain the highest rank before the war was over, needed rapid promotions, only available through active service in the elite formations of the Luftwaffe, Waffen-SS, or Brandenburg. The area for which he was responsible covered a strip of territory about 200 miles long and 20 to 25 miles deep. Many different units passed through this area, or used it for regrouping. There were exhausted divisions resting after month-long combat in the forward sectors, construction and engineering formations of the organization TOTE, supply units and workshops, a division of second-line troops, stomach men, unfit for frontline service due to ulcers or other stomach ailments, who served together because of their special diets. Each of these units had their own guard systems on duty, 24 hours a day, against possible partisan attack, but especially alert at night when surprise raids could be expected. The task of Ett and his staff was to check on all those guard details and ensure that no disguised enemy units infiltrated the second line. Ett carried out his inspections of the guards at night rather than during the day, travelling to the various locations either by heavy motorcycle and sidecar or by Kubelwagen, a kind of jeep. Ett and his men would approach the guard positions silently on foot, answering the challenge with the password, which was changed daily, and testing the effectiveness and awareness of the sentries. Where the guards were less than alert or unprepared, Ett would summon the officer on duty and report his findings, leaving it to the individual units to correct the problems. He would then file a report to the headquarters staff at the Abschnittskommando. Sleeping on guard duty was punished by court-martial and execution. On one of his rounds of inspecting the watchposts, Ett Volsing discovered an artillery unit which seemed too confused in their security arrangements for a formation in a high-risk sector. Ett sent for the duty officer, who turned out to be the artillery battalion commander himself. This high-ranking officer told Ett that he personally found difficulty sleeping at night and so always covered the post of night duty, leaving the other officers free to sleep at night. He invited Ett to his private quarters, and despite the differences in rank, was very friendly. Ett was a first lieutenant, and he a colonel. A glance around the colonel's quarters told Ett that the officer was a drinking man. Several bottles of German gin stood empty or half full around his desk, but he was by no means drunk. The colonel seemed impressed by Ett's impressive row of combat decorations, despite his obvious youth, and offered him a glass of gin. While sharing the drink, Ett inspected the titles of a few books which were lying around the room. To his surprise, he discovered a work by Thomas Mann, a Jewish writer, whose works were on the NS blacklist. There was something not right about this officer. The colonel rejected Ett's opinion that the battery guard could not react properly and demonstrated his unit's effectiveness immediately. He made one call on the field telephone to one of his subunits and brought forward an already planned shoot, ordering an immediate state of alarm, and in a mere 7 minutes all guns were firing. When silence returned, Ett expressed his admiration for the unit's efficiency and returned with the officer to his quarters, ready to exploit the colonel's sense of superiority and fondness for drink. Ett had decided to probe his politics. He did not have to wait long. After opening and emptying the first bottle of gin, the colonel began to talk frankly about his loyalty towards the Reich. He informed Ett that the war could never be won under the leadership of a former corporal, the Führer, and it was essential that he and his fellow Junkers should take over and return the Nazis to the gutter where they belonged. This was overt treason by an officer of the Wehrmacht, and Ett had to suppress his impulse to shoot the man on the spot. Instead, he behaved like an attentive pupil, admiring the opinions of a Junker officer, the military nobility of Prussian Germany for centuries. The ploy worked, and the colonel began to talk in greater depth, mentioning the names of fellow officers who were involved in plotting with him. Ett committed all the details of the conversation to memory, and once back at his own post, he wrote a full report detailing all he had been told. Ett could not believe the situation that he had discovered. It was his first experience of treason, and he was astonished that this situation could exist at the front. The treason was from within the ranks of the Wehrmacht, at a time when thousands of brave soldiers were sacrificing their lives every day in service of their Führer and Reich. Yet behind the lines, a handful of non-fighting nobility and aristocratic officers were plotting against the Führer and the heart of the Wehrmacht to undermine that sacrifice. As soon as Ett had completed his report, he used the field telephone to inform Obersturmbannführer Heiser his contact with SS General Kaltenbrunner. When Ett Volsink had been promoted to officer rank, he had been taken into the confidence of SS General Kaltenbrunner, second in command of the RSHA, as both an officer of the Brandenburg and the Allgemeine SS. He held a heavy responsibility to the National Socialist cause. Although the Brandenburg ZBV 800 was under the control of Admiral Canaris, Himmler and the SS kept a hand in the Brandenburg through men like Ett Volsink. It took him more than an hour to reach Berlin and make it clear to Heiser what he had accidentally discovered. The chain of conspiracy reached up into the high command, and as soon as Ett began to mention the names he had heard, he was told to keep his mouth shut and report personally to Berlin. The Geheimfeldpolizei would arrange for Ett's transfer documents and papers. Seething with anger at this treason, Ett set out to the nearest airfield, where he found a Messerschmitt ready and waiting to transport him. After a few hours, he landed at an airfield near Berlin, where he was met by a senior SS officer, who loaded him into a waiting car and rushed him to the central headquarters of the RSHA. The SS officer led Ett through the cordon of sentries into the building and through to Heiser's office. Ett only knew Heiser from his inauguration as an SS officer, but he welcomed Volsink like a long-lost son and put him at ease. Ett made his verbal report and handed over his written summary. Heiser was intensely interested and called for a female secretary to type it out. He left Ett alone with the secretary to complete the report, checking those details she could not make out in Ett's handwriting. Once finished, the report was an impressive-looking document, and Ett sat checking through it until Heiser returned. He told Ett to accompany him immediately, and clutching the papers, they hurried through the corridors and up the stairs into the depths of the building, passing black uniformed SS guards every 5 meters, each one armed with a heavy machine pistol. Heiser turned to Volsink and said, "The big boss is here." Ett was not clear as to which big boss he meant, and was confused by the speed of their journey through the unfamiliar building. A big oak door was opened by an SS guard, and they entered a room where he came face to face with SS General Kaltenbrunner. Stood next to Kaltenbrunner was no less a figure than SS Obersturmbannführer Heydrich, second only to Reichsführer Himmler. Heydrich waved aside Ett's embarrassment, cutting aside the usual formal greeting, by extending his hand and saying, "Heil Hitler, Obersturmführer, and welcome, sit down." Kaltenbrunner and Heydrich accepted copies of Ett's report and started to read through it. Another copy was handed to a fourth officer in the room, who was sitting beside a pile of documents. Ett studied Reinhard Heydrich closely. Heydrich was one of the most senior men in the Third Reich, and generally thought to be Himmler's natural successor. Ett found him to be a genuine Aryan aristocrat, intelligent, honest, direct, and clearly a natural leader. Heydrich behaved towards Ett Volsink, not as a senior general towards a junior officer, but as a respected comrade in the SS towards a fellow SS comrade. The administration officer at the desk had compared Ett's list with existing files on potential traitors. It was characteristic of Heydrich's style that Ett was not dismissed after signing the copies, but was allowed to remain while Heydrich drew his conclusions. Two of the names were already known as traitors and plotters, but six were new, The information was valuable and required action. Heydrich ordered a fixed procedure to verify the suspicions raised by Ett's report. It was then that Heydrich turned his attention to Ett Volsink personally, expressing his satisfaction in the way that Ett had combined his two functions as SS officer and Brandenburger. He told Ett that he would instruct the Geheimfeldpolizei to extend the short periods he spent between missions at Army Group headquarters so that he could maintain his surveillance work. Heydrich confided in Ett that the planned penetration of the SS into the Canaris stronghold of the Brandenburg had been wishful thinking in Ett's case, but had paid off, and that Ett was not to risk himself unduly in action, and to stay alive for the sake of the SS. This was the first and last meeting that Ett was to have with Reinhard Heydrich, as some weeks later the SS general was murdered by British Czech agents in Prague. This was not, however, the last time that Ett would encounter treason within the armed forces of the Reich. In the autumn of 1944, the Allied invasion of Europe had slowed down to a virtual standstill as reinforcements and supplies took longer to reach the advance units and German resistance had consolidated and regrouped. The Allied forces had captured a sizable area of France, but some regions were still under German control, and it was in this theatre of operations that Ett Volsink was assigned. Ett's orders at this time were in two separate parts: to destroy all installations which would prove useful to the enemy if captured, and to launch penetration raids on enemy targets which could not now be destroyed by direct artillery bombardment or air attacks. The penetration raids were being increasingly used as substitutes for the hard-pressed Luftwaffe and often required the Kampfgruppen to travel long distances into Allied-held territory. The situation at the front was fluid and confused due to the rapid Allied advance, which made it easy for German raiding parties to cross the lines and back again. There were so many actions to carry out that Ett had split his Kampfgruppe into two parts: two officers and the bulk of the men in one group, and Ett and about 16 French and English speakers in the other. Ett's smaller group were more compact and made regular river-crossing actions into the Allied lines. On this occasion, the action was again a river-crossing. The raid into the Allied area had been successful, and Ett's group were returning to their prearranged crossing point, but they were still in enemy territory. The radio operator made wireless contact with the GFP, the secret field police, and arranged for two canvas boats to be sent across to transport the raiding party. The boats would have to be rowed across with oars, as outboard motors at midnight would alert the whole front. When darkness fell, at around 20:00 hours, the Kampfgruppe moved around the mountain and down towards the river crossing point. Ett used night field glasses to monitor the area. He soon spotted over 20 riverboats assembled in a bay area of the river, obviously part of preparations to launch some kind of attack. He studied the area carefully and watched the movements of the enemy guards around the assembled river craft. The enemy river crossing was still in the early stages of assembly. He sent two men with marine and maritime technical experience down to the river to take a closer look. After half an hour, they reported back by walkie-talkie that two of the boats were ready to leave with fuel tanks full of petrol. The engine covers were labelled noiseless, and the waterways out into the river were free of obstacles. The information received raid appraisal, and immediate action was decided upon. The radio operator told the GFP to wait and hold back on sending the boats over to the raiding party. Ett and his group descended the slope to the river at utmost speed and hurried to the assembly area where the enemy boats were moored. They briefly lay low to allow a sentry to pass, then scrambled aboard one of the enemy craft, a type unknown to Ett. The craft were amphibious vehicles with retractable wheels, and Ett expected them to be of high interest to the German military designers. The engines were started, and proved indeed to be noiseless, far less than the sound of the stormy wind in the surrounding woods, which helped to cover the theft of the boats and the slipping of the moorings. The craft quickly crossed the waters to the German-held side. The absence of mines in the Bay Area greatly relieved Ett's fears of discovery or disaster. The radio warning to the GFP ensured that the German troops defending the opposite shoreline knew the craft were crossing and would hold their fire. The landing was safe and secure. The amphibious craft were quickly brought ashore and taken overland to an undercover area awaiting transportation to a rear area. The strange-looking vehicles were admired by a group of Waffen-SS troops who had welcomed the returning raiders. And we'll learn more about these strange amphibious craft in the next episode tomorrow.
You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.